This is the Heartland Collegiate Compendium. Principles of Microeconomics, Econ 10101. Lecture 25, delivered on the 20th of November of 2008. The title of this lecture is Forward Contracts and Auctions.
Today, forward contracts and auctions. I will begin with the latter subject, auctions. Interestingly, long ago, many people did know about auctions because in rural America or in small town America, there were auctions held rather frequently, especially with respect to estate sales. There would be an auction and people would gather and there would be an auctioneer. In fact, my father was an auctioneer in the old tradition with that high-powered fast talk that was quite impressive. It was actually a skill. I don't know if any of you have ever heard an auctioneer going on rattling. It sounds almost like babble, but it's quite a distinct and technical trade. And he took me to a few auctions. I guess he hoped that I could learn how to do that. Kind of America where people knew about auctions. Kids went to the auctions. It was a big thing. You'd go to the old man Creedy died, so the auction's going to be held, and everyone in town and in the countryside comes to the auction. That kind of passed from the scene, and then we didn't see people. Common people didn't so much see auctions for a very long time. They have come back in a form now with services like eBay. But eBay is not an oral auction, and it's also not a fast auction either. There are still auctions of the older tradition held, of course, and high-powered versions are held at for art and things like that in fancy galleries. But you might have seen auctions on eBay. Do any of you participate in eBay or do stuff in eBay? Well, as I have told you, I'm an eBay ho. I am there all the time. And I will take out people. If I have to, I will send viruses to their computers to stop them from bidding. It just drives me crazy, these mental morons who just wait till the last second to bid right above you. There's a problem with these auctions. I'll get into auctions a little more deeply. But auctions are a way by which we can achieve price discovery. Price discovery is a subtle term, and you've heard me talk about this term before. We rely on this assumption that there really is a price that reflects the value of something that is to be sold. We might not necessarily see this price. As a matter of fact, we wouldn't see this price. There's no price God who says, the price is $18.25. We don't see it. We're feeling, and as business people, we're feeling in the dark for the price of the goods that we sell. And I will be the first to tell you that when I was in business, I thought I was a genius. I'll find the damn price. I know what this thing will go for. And I was wrong by a mile. Price discovery is the process by which markets find a price at which both the buyer and the seller can agree to a transaction. The price at which both a buyer and a seller can agree to a transaction. Now, you remember in this course how I've always drawn those supply and demand curves, and there's the damn price right where they lock together, right there, yeah. Well, really, in the real world, it might not be a price. it might actually be sort of like a small price range where both the buyers and the sellers would be cool to the transaction. Okay, fine. Price discovery is not the discovery of a point so much as it is a region where we can clear the inventory with the quantity that would be demanded. Okay? So that price, you know, well, it is exactly $5.99. Exactly? Well, what happens if it was $5.98? Would the world come to an end? Well, no. So price discovery is not the discovery of a point so much as it is a region where we're okay with the transaction. We can all live with it. You know, you might go out into the market for a job and be looking for maybe, $42,000 a year. Now, would you object terribly if they offered you 50? Well, no, man, I want 42. Come on. Yeah, go ahead.
See, when I used to go to Blockbuster, they would reduce the price of a video, and it would be like $197, which I thought was a real pain in the ass because it was easier for it to flip out $2. So I asked the manager guy, well, why do you guys do it? And he religiously claimed that it was person would really think they're getting a hell of a deal paying $197 rather than $2.
Let me bring that one up. There is a psychology of pricing. Now, if you took a course in marketing from me, or in fact, if you take my enterprise course over at State, you'll hear me talk about this psychology of pricing, is that in marketing, they call it price point. They do a lot of work with focus groups, but unfortunately, there's some myth in it, too. But they work with focus groups to see where there are triggers. And sometimes they'll actually, we measure people physiologically to see where you get notable changes in the reaction on a price. So we do know that people will react differently to $1.99 than to $2. They will focus on that first number because we are left to right readers in our culture. So they know very well that the first thing they'll see is that dollar. And then they will see what's after it. Now the $1.97, that is a theory that came up. It's been off and on, yes, no. Because the theory goes like this. You look at the dollar. Western readers look right, left to right, and they'll look dollar. Okay. And then they'll see 99 and they'll say, now I can adjust that. That's $2. But if they see 97, that disrupts their adjustment calculus in their mind. That's the theory that guy is trying to, essentially is behind this. That the price point is at $1.97. And 7 has more use than 8 does. Because the 7 is a number that people do not associate with higher. They associate it with lucky and possibly lower. That's the idea. Is it true? Big argument about it. I mean, I've got some marketers who will swear up and down. We've done studies on this. We know this. And others will say, oh, crap. Just do it at $1.99. And then there are, of course, others who have gone to a strategy of what are called flat dollars, where they just say $2. One of the great stores that does this, dollar stores, dollar for everything. It's just $1. We don't mess with you. It's $1. Or the stores that do it at other price points at $2, $5. We don't mess with $1.99 and all that kind of stuff, $4.99. It's $5. Just give me a $5 bill, and then, of course, the tax blows that out of the water, but we don't have to worry about that too much because people seem to be blind to the taxes until they pay them. They don't calculate the tax and things. Well, fortunately, Americans aren't good at arithmetic that way. Yeah, that's the idea. There are two theories. One is play with the price left to right. The other is flatten the price out. And both strategies actually work. Is one better than the other? It is hard to tell. And it also has to do with the type of product, too. Very high-priced products don't 99 cents, 97 cent people. It doesn't matter. Just give them a dollar price. I've been recently pricing professional video equipment, and you don't see 99s on anything. It's $3,329. That's it.
But of course, then that's $3,330, but who cares at that price level? That's a good point. This price discovery process, the idea from the old Adam Smith classical school of economics, is that if you put enough people together on the buying and the selling side and let them work it out, just in their own minds and arguing with each other possibly, a price will be discovered. We have to assume there's got to be a price. I mean, why there can't be an economy if there aren't prices. And the best way in the Adam Smith model is let the people fight it out for themselves. And unfortunately, the downside of that, of course, is that rich people will be able to get things better than poor people will, because they'll be able to bid up the prices, and that'll cream a lot of people. However, there's another side to the market. There are the suppliers who will fight to bring down the price to get more customers. So in a way, on the demand side, your fellow demanders are your adversaries and the suppliers are your friends. Interestingly enough, if you think of it that way, they're not really your friends, but they are actually working to your advantage, because they will try to bring down the price to sell more of the product, while the demanders are going to try to bring up the price to get it away from you. It's kind of an odd twist on the old idea that the bad guys are on the other side of the market, the sellers. Okay, let me give you a couple of ideas here. First of all, eBay, you've seen eBay. Someone sets out an initial price. And then bidders just come in and they just keep bidding up the price as the time runs down on the auction. And then there's an ending time, and whatever price is there is whoever offered the highest bid when the bell sounds gets the product, unless the reserve price hasn't been met. Okay, now here's the problem. And this will be the first big term for the day, is what's called winner's curse. And this is a warning to you. Winner's curse. It is actually often the case that the winning bid is higher than it could be. I have seen on eBay bidding for a used product go above the price of the new product. You could buy the new product on Amazon.com for less than the final bid. Use products that go up higher than what the true value is if you were to look at a non-bidding auction type of market. It happens, and I've seen it over and over again, and I have actually almost, just because of the fight, jumped in at the last minute. I'm going to teach that son of a bitch. I'll bid 1,000 on this thing. There, eat that. And then I thought, no. In fact, one of the strategies that I finally learned was to just punish. There's bidders that you know, and I've identified there's a cluster of about 50 assholes on eBay. And they're actually all the same bidding group. They will just beat the hell out of you. They'll win at all costs. And some of my friends and I are now in the business of just making them pay high prices. We'll bid it up, and because they are using computer programs and also using just pure hubris, they'll overbid you. They'll take it. They'll want it just to get it. And they'll pay. In one case of an auction, there was a copy of popular software program. I mean, you can get it new for about $150. The bidding went up, and in about a minute to go, one of my friends bid $190. Sure enough, one of those idiots went in and bid $195, won it. We just bid them up. Sure, if you want to do this, we'll just bankrupt you if you want to keep doing this kind of nonsense. Winner's curse happens a lot. Watch it. Because sellers actually rely on winner's curse. Because especially in a hot auction, people will just keep leapfrogging each other, and they will not be thinking about the intrinsic value of the product. They'll actually be paying for the win. So you see, the auction becomes it becomes an auction for more than just the item itself. It becomes an auction for the item plus the entertainment value. And then that's when essentially the price discovery process has essentially discovered a price, but it's not the price of the product. It's actually the price of of the product plus the entertainment value of it. And that, of course, is true with lottery tickets. The lottery tickets are definitely unfair. As far as gaming theory goes, they're completely unfair. But you buy them only partially to win. You buy them also for the thrill of the joy of scratching those stupid-ass little things and all of that. Keep that in mind, that just because a price is being discovered, it might not necessarily be just the price of the product. In fact, we see this overpaying, price discovery. It's not a distortion. I'll call it a distortion, price discovery distortion in all kinds of markets. Good example, Elliot Spitzer. You remember Elliot Spitzer? The former square-jawed, get-tough-on-crime guy from New York who was outed for buying very, very expensive prostitutes from a prostitution house. Now, Elliot lived in New York City. $25, he could have gotten it on the street. Now, he got it in Washington, D.C. from a madam, paid thousands of dollars for these lovely young ladies. And, of course, there is a safety factor, but there's also something else involved, too. He wasn't paying just the price of the sexual service. The price of sex. He was paying the price of a sexual service, which included sex and a lot more. The thrill of a very pretty woman, very classy, very elegant surroundings, as well as safety. So he wasn't paying just for sex. For that, he could have paid $25. Elliot paid $12,000. So it wasn't the price discovery of just sex. It was more than just sex. Okay, now, when I talked about eBay, I am talking about one type of auction, which is probably the one you're most familiar with, which is called the English auction. English auctions are auctions, bidding starts low, and rises until a sale, i.e., that is, a seller, is discovered at a price point. So in an auction in a gallery in New York City, in a fine art gallery, and I could see all of you there someday, sitting there very quietly, looking around, wearing very fancy clothes. Of course, these auctions oftentimes, in the old days, it's not so much that way now, but in the old days, the auctions were not, I bid, there were hand signals that were given for the auction. And oftentimes, the buyers were not the ones who were at the auctions. Their specialized representatives who knew how to do auctions properly were the ones who were actually there. But we have this art painting here. Mr. O'Sullivan, blue nude. We will begin the bidding at $250,000. And of course, at that point, you give your signal that you'd pay that. We have $250,000. Do we have $275,000? Stop it. You are the subject of this nude painting. You can't bid. Do we have $270,000? $270. Do I have $270,000? And over there, your hand, you give a sign that you're going to be willing to pay that. We have $270,000. Do we have $300,000? $300,000 for this blue nude of Mr. O'Sullivan. And of course, at that point, you give your signal that you're going to take it. And we have $300,000. Do we have $310,000? At that point, you, Mr. Matthews, you scratch your groin, and then you say, okay, we are now at $310,000. Do we have $320,000? $320,000. Anyone at $320,000? 20,000. 310,000 going once, 310,000 going twice, 310,000. Bam! See how the price is rising until a price was discovered at which we could sell the painting. 310,000. Okay? That's an English auction. There's another kind of auction, interestingly enough, and I've seen these and they're kind of cool. Dutch auctions. A Dutch auction works the opposite way. A Dutch auction starts with a high bidding, starts high, and then goes down until a buyer is found. Does anyone? You actually live in a world where Dutch, at least certainly one Dutch auction is very common. And what does anyone know the example of a Dutch auction? Yeah. Yes! Buying a house is a Dutch auction! Because you start with your dream price to sell your damn house at, $300,000. But of course, your house is a trailer down there in the trailer park. And you keep going down and down and down, and then, you might get desperate. Okay, fine, I'll throw in the dog. I'll throw in the kids. I'll throw in the love seat. And all this velvet painting. You keep bringing the price down until you find a buyer. As a matter of fact, I actually did studies. One of my research papers when one of my specialties is real estate and urban studies, finding out if there was a relationship between what the list price was, what the sale price was, and how long the house would be on market. In other words, seeing how long it would take for price discovery, given the size of the gap between initial price and the discovery and the price that was finally discovered. Theoretically, my idea was that if your price that you list at is very far, high, way above the final sale price, you should see a longer time on market. To a certain extent, yes, you did. It's kind of an obvious idea, but the question then, it's practical because it informs real estate agents. Look, when you're talking to people that want to sell their house, it's a very good idea for you to not let them go overboard on their listing price, because that will mean the house will just sit on market longer. So if you have some understanding of where houses are selling, well, it might not be a good idea to allow your seller to list way, way above that, because that's just going to mean that the seller sits there on market for a long time and you end up showing the house a lot to people who simply say no because of the list price or something like that. So it had a practical implication. And also finding out if you get close to list price, if you list above the discovery price that is existing with comparables, but you don't go that far above it, is there a chance that you can sell above the prevailing discovery price? In other words, if you put way up here, you're just going to collapse down to the discovery price. But if you put way just up here, is it possible that the discovery price, you could tease it up a little bit? The answer to that was yes. If you don't go way out of bounds, sometimes the best idea in the world is to have, and this, there's an old game with that. You've got a product to sell. You've got the same product to sell. It's really worth $2. You ask $18. You ask $3. Oh, God, thank God. Turns out the two of you are working together. Okay. You see how you can mess with the discovery price a little bit that way. If you don't go way overboard, but you know that someone could go overboard with you, someone has tried to go overboard with you, you're so damn grateful for someone who looks honest, has a sweet face, that little do I know that she's the devil incarnate and she's working with Mr. Satan over here. You see the idea there? Okay, those are Dutch auctions, and they're actually just a common thing. Now there's one other kind, and I actually wrote a highly theoretical paper on this a long time ago called, the sealed bid auction. The sealed bid auction. These are actually quite common in government financing, where what will happen essentially is that different buyers or sellers will submit bids, and the other side of the market will then open up those bids to see which one is the best. So if I am a government agency and I want to do a contract to build a building, I will put out a call for bids, and then different contractors will submit sealed bids to me to do the work, and I will open those up and find the lowest bid, and then I will award the contract to that lowest bidder. That's a sealed bid auction. It's just an auction where the offers are made by sealed bid, and then the best of those is accepted. I've done sealed bid auctions myself, selling website domains and all of that. Simply, you submit your bids, the highest bid will win the auction. It was sealed bid English, and basically no one knows what anyone else is bidding. The idea there is to keep the market on the other side from assuming a price by looking at the signals from the other bidders. That way, you are going to get a truer reflection of value. In other words, the constructors, the construction companies, won't look at each other. They'll have to do it by calculating their costs instead of getting a signal from the other auction, from the other bidders. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, as a matter of fact, military contracts are very commonly sealed bid contracts. And the unfortunate thing, of course, is that you can get communication among the bidders. Essentially, you win this auction, I win that auction. Or we bid so close to each other, then they have to take us, they would take us both on when we propose to do it as a joint project. Something along that line. You can have gaming in sealed bid auctions. In many cases, those kinds of activities are illegal, but they happen. In insurance brokerage, for example, an insurance broker represents... Oh, and I need to do this right now. I have to tell you this. Agent, when I use the word agent, an agent represents the seller. A broker represents the buyer. I meant to tell you that before now, but I've got to bring it out on the table. Okay, now in insurance, you guys, almost all of you, well, I'm almost sure all of us in here, deal with insurance agents. They represent the sellers of insurance, the insurance companies. However, in big dog world of big companies, they have insurance brokers who represent their interests when the companies want to get insurance. So in insurance brokers, what they'll do is they'll have some major company that needs insurance come to them and say, all right, we're going to do your insurance. Now, in big insurance, you actually have three layers. You have the producer, who is actually the salesman. You have the account executive, who oversees the account once it's produced. And then you have lower level people who actually do the underwriting and all that. But let's say we're at the broker level and you're a broker and a company has come, you're a big company and you come to me, I need insurance for my new manufacturing operation. I say, okay. Then I get all the specifications together and I go out to the insurance companies and I say, here's what I need insurance on. These are the caps, these are the coverages, these are all the umbrellas and all this kind of stuff. And then I submit this to different insurance companies and I say, all right, give me a bid. That is a sealed bid auction. Now, in that business, there are games that can be played. You could actually go to another insurance broker to see what she could do better than I could do. And we could end up crossing paths in this. That's why I would try to lock the market. If you come to me, I'll lock the market so that if she tries to go to the same insurance companies I've gone to, they can't offer, talk to her about it because I've locked them in on me for this deal. But at the same time, you will have these insurance company underwriters. They're trying to figure out what price do I do on this? What, you know, working through all of the complexities of the actuarial tables, the probabilities of problems and all that, the losses. It's just a very complicated world, and it's, you'll make a lot of money if you get into that as a, your business major after your business work, degree. But sometimes the insurance companies will actually, you know, all right, I'm at a loss. Give me a hint. What are you getting from so-and-so? Where else are you going? What kind of a price are we looking at? And of course, technically, the broker has to say, I can't tell you that. Come on. But of course, the broker has an incentive to break the rules. All right, look, you're a good friend of mine. Okay, you've worked with me before. I got something from this other insurance company. I'm not going to tell you who it is, but it was a big insurance company. They quoted the premium, 1 year premium, at $212,000. Now, you didn't hear this from me. You understand? Okay. So, what are you going to do with your bid for this insurance package? Sure. Now, the truth of the matter is, as the insurance broker, did I really get a bid of $212,000? Hell no. I probably saw a bid of $250,000 at the low. But I'll lowball your ass because you'll lowball that ass, and then I'll get ass at a low price. Okay? And so, may God, if you ever repeat what I'm telling you, I will kill you. I'm podcasting. Jesus Christ. Okay. There are games in sealed bid auctions. There really are games that can be played in sealed bid auction that distort it. But at the end of the day, probably these still work out to be quite good in the sense that if you really couldn't do $210,000, you wouldn't step in. If $212,000 was just ridiculous, you would simply say, kiss my butt. No! No! I can't do it. Oh, hell no! My numbers come out no better than $230,000. But if you really could do $210,000, what does it hurt for me to get you real on your bid? Do you see how, even though there seems like there's cheating going on, if this really is a fair market and he couldn't do $210,000, he wouldn't do it. But if he can, he is going to beat a $212,000 price. Okay? You see the idea there? Sometimes it looks like there's cheating going on, but sometimes the cheating is actually advancing the discovery of a good price. Okay. Now, I'm going to go on to the concept of forward contracts. And I'll motivate this. It's really easy to motivate this. And I was actually introduced to the world of real forward contracts when I did oil and gas years ago. But let's try it this way. Sign a contract with me, ma'am, and I will provide you with gasoline, guaranteed, at $3 a gallon for the rest of your life. You see? There's an ups downside to that. Well, gas is so low, right? Come on, you know, bite me. But what if gasoline prices do what they did before? Go up $4, $5. You've heard the doomsayers, $8, $10 a gallon. I'm offering you a contract, a guarantee of a fixed delivery price. What say you? Well, I don't want you to try to agree to it. But do you see the idea that locking in a price or some other aspect, a forward contract, is an agreement that guarantees some aspect of the delivery or the sale? A contract, an agreement that guarantees some aspect of the delivery or the sale. I should say the purchase or the sale. Oftentimes it's the price, but there's also quantities that can be a part of it too. Futures contracts are standardized this way. Forward contracts happen quite a bit. I mean, every one of you actually lives in a world, will live in a world where there are some forward contracts. They guarantee something like fixed rate mortgages, or actually, in a way, a forward contract, because they're guaranteeing you a fixed interest rate over the life of the loan. Whereas a variable rate mortgage, which is the stupidest ass thing anyone would ever take on, by the way, a variable rate mortgage does not have that forward guarantee on it. Your employment contract will probably be a forward contract. Your wage will not vary from day to day. It will be a guarantee of a wage and a certain number of hours of work, possibly, and certain working conditions. There will be all kinds of guarantees in the agreement. That's what will essentially constitute the agreement, is a set of forward guarantees. Now, forward contracts, to give you an idea, when I was in the oil and gas business, we were in just basically wildcatters out in the middle of the patch, and there was a truck that would come by and get the oil right out of the tanks where we were storing it. We could either do spot, which meant that we took whatever the prevailing was, or we could make a forward contract that would guarantee that the company that was picking it up, Coqueline, would give us a specific amount of money per barrel for 6 months, over the life of 6 months of the forward contract. So we could either take the spot and bet that oil prices would go up, or we could take a forward and get a guarantee of a price. The downside, of course, of the forward was that if the spot went way up, we were stuck getting a lower price per barrel of our oil. But the other side of it was we had certainty in our budgeting. We knew how much we were going to get. And if oil prices went down, well, we would win in that case. So you're essentially, with a forward contract, you are removing uncertainty. You are removing uncertainty. Now, let me give you an idea of why removing uncertainty is good. You see, for some, uncertainty is good because uncertainty is where you can make your money. And essentially, what forward and futures and options markets do is reallocate risk away from those who don't want it and to those who do want it. If you are in the business of risk, making your money off risk, then you will be willing to buy risk. And if you are in the business of getting away from risks of certain types, you would be willing to sell those risks. Or maybe even pay someone to take the risks from you. Now, let me tell you how this would work in the real world. And this will take you to my article, Pumpkins and Futures. And I'll let you read that to get more of the detail on it. But think about it this way. You are a trucking company. Your business is transport and delivery of merchandise. Your business is trucks. Your business is the business of moving things around. That's what you do. And you're a decent-sized trucking company. Well, let's say you have a fleet of 100 trucks. You're all over the Midwest, maybe down into the South, and you're trying to expand, of course, and all that. When gasoline prices go up, your profits go down. When gasoline prices go down, your profits go up. You are not in the business of gasoline. You're not in the hydrocarbons business. That's not in your business model. That's not your core competence. Gasoline is not what you do. You do trucking. Suppose that you had a way that you could write or buy contracts. I am going to make a contract so that if the price of gasoline goes up, I make money. A futures contract on gasoline. If the price of gasoline goes down, I lose money on these futures contracts, on these forward contracts. Okay? So that means that in your trucking business, if the gas price goes up, you lose money, obviously, because you're paying more for your gas. And if gas prices go down, you make money, make more money. Because obviously you're not paying as much for gas, so your profit line is. Now, let's take that you, let's assume that you go into a futures market and you actually buy futures contracts on gasoline. Now, a futures contract is nothing but a standardized forward contract. Futures markets, all they do is guarantee with specific amounts and specific times of delivery and all of that. That's how futures markets work. It's just a forward contract with a standards, all kinds of standards. So it's not an on-the-fly custom deal. It's all packaged, prepackaged. You go into the futures market. Grr. Pen died. You go into the futures market. And you buy contracts on gasoline. In your futures market, when gas prices go up, you make money. You're the winner. And if gas prices go down, you lose money. If you arrange it properly, do you see how you can arrange your futures contracts so the gasoline prices no longer affect your profit? Do you see it? Essentially, when gas prices go up, your trucks pay more, but you're making money off your futures contracts. And when gas prices go down, you make more money off your trucking, but you lose money on your futures contracts. So do you see how, if you arrange this properly, you have completely, or at least substantially, remove the volatility of your profits caused by gasoline prices? You're not in the gasoline business. So why should you be trying living in profit volatility off something that you don't need to have causing volatility in your profits? This is hedging. This is hedging. Farmers do this too. In grain markets, if you were a farmer, you obviously will make more money if corn prices go up. You'll make less money if corn prices go down. So why wouldn't you make arrangements in a futures market that would cause the opposite to happen with your futures contracts? When grain prices go up, you lose money, but when grain prices go down, you make money. In other words, you would be actually the writer of the futures markets in that regard. Well, writer is what we call a seller. Okay? That's what we call it. Do you see how in a business model, you don't have to live in a world of volatility on things that aren't your core business? You can hedge those sources of volatility right there. Yeah, you might think, well, this kind of sucks because when gas prices go down, I lose money. Well, so what? You're making more money in your business, trucking business. You shouldn't be relying on gasoline prices as your way to make a profit. You should have that out of your business model because you are in trucking, not gasoline. The same is true in any market. In fact, it can get to the point where why should you be rewarded or bailed out when there were ways that you could have avoided those risks in your business? You see, what is happening in that futures market, if you buy a contract on gasoline, someone is selling you that contract. There's always another side to a market. There's a writer for every buyer, a seller for every buyer. So someone is on the other side of that contract willing to bear the risk of gas prices going up. That's that person's business. That's that investment house, that brokerage house's business. They're in the business of gasoline price volatility. And they are willing to eat the other side of the market with you for a price. That you'll pay a price for these. And there are, but at the same time, the whole idea here is that there is someone out there willing to take this risk. So if you suffer because you accepted that risk on your own, why is it that there should be a bailout of you? The same would apply to insurance. Well, I didn't have no insurance on this home, and goddamn, there was a tornado. It just tore this place to shreds. Well, how often do tornadoes? Well, about once every month they had come in the summer. Well, why didn't you have insurance? Well, I didn't. Well, why don't you bail me out? Look at me. I'm crying. My kids don't have nothing. Why would you bail them out if they could have done this themselves? They could have hedged the risk. This is the same thing going on right here. Why is it that you should be bailed out? This can apply to the auto market right now. For years, the auto industry has had its problems. People have screamed about it. Conservatives have yelled about it. Liberals, Michael Moore wrote about it. I mean, this is just, did a movie about it. And here they are, collapsed. And one of the things that caused them to collapse was they said, well, these Japanese auto manufacturers kicked our asses would be one of their explanations. Well, how could they have hedged that risk? They could have. Most Americans would have said, bite me to that. Why didn't they buy equity stakes in the winners, in the companies? Why didn't they get involved with those companies so that if those companies won, they won with those companies and lost on their own operations? If those companies lost, then they would win with their own cars and lose with the Japanese equity investments. They could have done it a lot more intelligently. They could have hedged the risk of competition by unifying and joining with and making profits off their competition. If the competition kicks their asses, they make money off their competition's cars. And, of course, there were reasons why that couldn't happen. There were antitrust laws, but there were also ways that they could have done it. And some car companies did do this to a limited extent. They got into joint venture agreements with these companies. They're not nearly as bad a shape as the companies that tried to stand on their own and ride it out and do the competition game. This is why we have forward contracts. Forward contracts move risk away from you. If you don't want risk, there are ways to move it to someone else. Markets form around risks. That's what one of the powers of capitalism is, that risk can become a commodity. And a commodity, there's a buyer out there. There's got to be a price. That's what price discovery is all about. If you have a risk that you don't want, there is a way, or at least you can try to get awfully creative, but oftentimes there's already a way out there to package that risk and sell it to someone who is willing to buy that risk from you and take it on and move that risk out of your business model. And so keep that in mind when you hear about, you know, the evils of future markets or forward contracts and how we've got to take away these speculators. Well, you see, the speculators, these are those evil, greedy people who drove up the price of gasoline. Those speculators are crucial to the price discovery process because they're in it to make money, but they're also in it because they are willing to take on risks to make that money. That's why all those speculators, the ones on the other side of the market, just sitting there with piles and piles of money, writing and buying futures contracts, they're absolutely essential because they are the way that the price will be discovered for the risk that someone wants to get rid of. And it's just a matter of finding that price, and if you can handle it, then you should get the risk out of your portfolio or your business. I'm not going to go into options in this class, and I'm sure some of you will slam into me in financial management class, probably, maybe here, but over at State, you'll hit me there, and you'll hear about options, which are a fun way to hedge risk in stocks so that you can lock in prices and all that. Options are just another type of forward contract. However, I want you to read that article, Pumpkins and Futures. I'll ask you a few questions, and I'll include it in the review that we do on Tuesday. It's not hard, but make sure you have, you might want to have a piece of paper and a calculator with you. It doesn't have to be a fancy calculator, it's just arithmetic. But you have to understand, futures markets are a very specialized kind of forward contract. But I explain forward contracts in that article too. So again, read that for the weekend. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.